Well, as part of our big questions services, we've wanted to demonstrate, in a sense, that these are questions that very much impact on real life. And so, as well as seeing what the Bible has to say about them, we've wanted to interview people who've had some kind of experience of the question in hand. And we're going to interview two sets of people today, actually, Mark and Karen Chapman, and then James Cunliffe. So can I invite Mark and Karen to come up now? And if you just join me over here. Thanks so much for being willing to share with us today. It's lovely to have you here. Why don't you start by just telling us where you're from, how long you've been over here in the UK?
So I was born and bred in Cape Town, and we moved to the UK in 2000.
And I was born in the UK. At 3 months, I went to Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe, where I was schooled and spent 2 years in the Rhodesian Army, and then went to Cape Town University to study.
Okay, and how long have you been in Maidenhead?
About 12, 13 years.
Okay, fantastic. Now, we're going to zoom quite a long way back today to 1993, 23 years ago, and you're both in Cape Town at that stage, and you're attending St. James Church. Just tell us a bit about the church and your involvement in it.
Yeah, so St. James is a part of the Church of England in South Africa, and it is located in a quiet residential suburb called Kenilworth. It's a large church. It hosts about 3 services on a Sunday, and it has approximately 1,300 people attending each service. The congregation is made up of a good mix of the people of South Africa, both young and old, but it's a vibrant evangelical church. And my ministry, area of ministry and involvement in the church was in the way of playing the piano as part of the music team.
And I was involved in the men's ministries and in the manning the information desk, along with working with welcoming newcomers to the church.
Mm. So it's a lot bigger than St. Mary's, 1,500 people, great big auditorium.
Huge auditorium.
Yeah.
Designed with the stage up and enabling the gospel to be preached out, probably about 6 sizes of this going around this way.
Okay. Well, it's kind of aspirational for us with Project Connect, but I don't think we'll ever quite get that many people in here. So when you arrive at the evening service on the 25th of July, it's just kind of Sunday as usual for you guys.
Yeah, it was. It was a normal Sunday. We had gone to the morning service. We have quite a good family life. We always had a Sunday roast. And so we'd gone to my mum and dad, had a Sunday roast together, and we were just going to go to the evening service, as we usually did. It was winter. It was dark, rainy, and very cold.
But as it turned out, that was a Sunday that was going to change your lives forever. Just tell us what happened.
Yeah, so we were seated, amazingly enough, all together with my mum and dad in the same row, and my sister as well, and a friend of hers. And it was while there was a duet being sung that the doors burst open up to the side in the front of the stage, and a group of armed gunmen faced us and started firing at us, and threw hand grenades, which had been wrapped in nails to magnify the impact, into the congregation. There was also a sniper that was standing with them, and he was shooting at people who didn't manage to get down in time, or any of those who thought they could escape and had started to run, but there wasn't enough time.
And the shooting ceased when an off-duty police officer, who was a member of the congregation, took out his pistol and started to fire back. And the effect was that there were 11 people killed, and there were about 55 people maimed. Some of them had horrible injuries for the rest of their life. There were probably about 3,000 of the members seriously emotionally damaged, but the people who were there on the night were really, really badly traumatized by it. We had 3 soldiers, three Russian sailors that were part of a ministry outreach for Russian ships that were going to the Antarctic to resupply the Russians there. And they, three of those were killed. They were horribly maimed. So,
I mean, as most of us will, I mean, God willing, never go through anything like this. But perhaps you'd be happy to share what went through your heads when you saw these events beginning to unfold.
I think for me, I had never seen or experienced any violence really in my life. And so I actually didn't even recognize the sound of the gunfire. I thought it was fireworks. I didn't realize what was happening. And you don't have time to think, and the adrenaline just kicks in. And fortunately, Mark pulled me to the ground, and we got down in between the pews. And I can remember feeling extremely fearful, extremely panicking, and very stressed by it all, to the extent that when the shooting finally stopped, I had the imprint of my nails in my hand, that I was obviously trying to just hold on to something. While the bullets flew, the hand grenades started to explode. The smell of gunfire started to fill the church. And then eventually, the firing stopped. And then ultimately, we started hearing the sounds of sirens and police cars and making their way to the scene of crime. Mm. But those sounds, those smells, those cries are forever etched in your mind.
Mm. I think for me, it was an incredible disbelief at what I was seeing. And clearly, once you experience that, my military mode kicked in from when I spent time in the army. And immediately made sure that people around me could be protected from some way. The minister then called for every person who's trained in medical aid and medics to make their way down to the front to assist with those who've been killed and injured. And so I went down to help. But it was a surreal feeling as we went back after. Once the medics came in and they took over, you kind of think to yourself, what actually happened? Surreal experience going back to the car, which still puzzles me today.
And what impact did, I mean, I suppose, it, particularly in the aftermath, what impact did this have on you both personally?
Yeah, I don't think one can ever be the same after you've gone through something like that. Any trauma like that must leave a scar. But I had little understanding of the trauma and the effect it would have on me. And so we left the church, and we went to my mum and dad's home. And I remember my dad saying, I think I'll just make a call to your sister, because she lives in Johannesburg. She might hear that not all was well. So he picked up the phone, and he told her that she might hear something on the news. But there was just a bit of an upset at church tonight, but we were all fine. It was like we didn't even realize what we'd gone through. And in the meantime, Mark made us some Welsh sugared tea. We didn't even recognize how shocked we were. We just thought we could come home and walk away from that situation, not really realizing that. When we then left my parents and went home, we switched the radio on, and all of a sudden, you had this insatiable appetite just to find out how many had been killed, who was killed, did we know anybody who was killed, and you just could not stop yourself watching. And then as the TV came, it became even more graphic. And so you were just right back there within a moment. We turned out the light, had no idea that we wouldn't be able to sleep. And actually, I couldn't turn out the light because I was scared of the dark. So I wanted the light on.
And I wanted, in true military mode, the light off so I could see the enemy coming. So
so it was an interesting first night. We struggled. In my family, in subsequent weeks thereafter, my dad didn't want to talk about it. My sister didn't want to talk about it. I needed to talk about it. So we had all these conflicting dynamics whenever we were together as a family, but it wasn't an easy time. Monday morning, we went to work thinking we could go to work. We didn't realize that what we'd gone through was so huge. And you were just unable to work. You could not focus. You couldn't do anything. So we left and we ended up at home again, just watching TV yet again.
I think it It changed our lives forever. I don't think we were so emotionally and mentally scarred. I mean, we suffered what they term now post-traumatic stress syndrome, not only from the belief of the attack, but just, you know, the nature of it and why it was so gruesome. It did take months and some cases like Karen years to work through the issues that came from that.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it being a church, it's a building that is full of Christian believers, yourselves included, but this must have had some kind of impact on your faith.
Yeah, I think for me personally, it shook my faith right to the core. I could not get my head around why God didn't protect me. I was in his house, I was at church. Why didn't he protect me from such a violent, abhorrent, vicious attack? And so what I believed as a Christian was really thrown into sharp focus, and it made me think about why I believed what I believed and why did I think that I should not be there that night. It's almost like, why should you not get cancer? Why should, you know, bad things happen to good people? So my thinking, my foundation of holding on to things that God had in store for me was slightly wrong, in fact massively wrong, because it wasn't that God didn't protect me that night, but on the night that's actually where I was. But now was a time of testing for me, because I knew that God was sovereign and I knew his promises, but this was my moment where I actually had to stand on those promises and be strong enough to do that. But it really did cause me to consider the sovereignty of God in my life.
And I think for me, in one sense, it deepened my faith. I had to trust that God's in control, not only of our day-to-day lives, but in the circumstances surrounding us, both globally and in our day-to-day travels. And it also has to be held in balance in understanding and accepting God's sovereignty in our lives. I think we then realized, actually, Christians are not immune from these kind of attacks. We're not, just because we're Christians doesn't make us exempt from the sufferings that we see that go on in the world.
Mm. Now, South Africa was a very violent place at the time, but it's interesting. I mean, you gave me a book written by the pastor of your church, kind of reflecting on these events, and in there he wrote somewhere, it was as if a kind of invisible line had been crossed with these attacks. What do you think he meant by that?
I think this is a crime that had been committed by people who had no particular political affiliation with any particular party. In fact, St. James had an outreach ministry to a lot of the communities where the gunmen had come from. So maybe that's how they got to know where the church was. But I think the irrationality of it all was just huge. I mean, Nelson Mandela had been released. There were processes and procedures being set in place for the new elections that were to put in a new majority government. There was no real legitimate reason for the attack. We just could not understand it. Mm. And the invisible line that had been crossed really is that the first time, I think, parishioners worshipping in a church had actually experienced and had been subjected to the violence like this.
Yeah. Now, I guess for most of us sitting here, God willing, we won't personally experience this, but we're very aware of these things going on in our world. I guess particularly closest to home for us, the Paris bombings earlier this year. Now, when you guys read about those things, hear about those things on the news, you must hear them in a very different way to other folk. What's that like for you?
Yeah, I think we went into group counselling. The church put in a group counselling arrangement straight away to help the volume of people who were impacted. And one of the things they said to us that was eventually the experience and the abhorrent things that you saw will find a place to sit in your psyche somewhere, and it will be there. But it doesn't take much to uncover that. And so if you see a Paris bombing or something like that, and you watch that on your TV, I just know what's going to happen that night to those victims. I just I just know that there's a long and hard road ahead, and a sense of empathy is there, and it's not an easy thing. You know, the next day dawns, but you walk with that for a long time.
Just finally, as Christian believers who've been through that kind of thing, what would your message be to us today?
I think, you know, evil is part of a broken world, and we fear things. We fear things that we actually can't control. So we fear our health, we fear the loss of a job, and we fear our life ultimately in those situations, particularly a massacre like we experienced. But those things are all ultimately in God's hand. And I think that for us was the greatest challenge, that God's sovereignty can involve good and bad things, and that's, he still was in control that night despite us not feeling that, and he has been faithful to us throughout that.
I think for those of us who are Christians, we need to realize that God's in control and he's divinely guiding events. I think he'll keep you safe in the eye of the storm. And for those who don't yet believe, I'd urge you to consider the fragility of life. And we saw what could happen in 30 seconds, because that's all it took for the attack, was just 30 seconds.
Yeah. So. And I think the greatest lesson we learned is that is the real tragedy of a situation like that is not whether you die from a massacre, whether you die from the tsunami, or whether you die through an aging process, ill health, whether you're young or old. The tragedy is that if you die without Christ, because we're all going to die, so it's just the process that's unknown for each one of us and will be different for each one of us. But that's the issue, is can you trust him with your life, and can you trust him with your death?
Mark and Karen, thank you for sharing so honestly. Do take a seat. Let's give them a round of applause, and I'm going to invite James up to the front now as well. Now, James, you're coming at this from a slightly different perspective. Just tell us what that is.
Yeah, I mean, I spent over 30 years in the British Army, three long tours in counter-terrorism in Northern Ireland, and then subsequently combat operations in Kosovo and Afghanistan. Mm. And then lastly, some robust peacekeeping with the UN in Congo.
Mm. Now, one of the interesting things about this question that's come up, a very, very common question, was about world peace. You know, why can't there be world peace? What's going on with all these conflicts that we just hear about again and again across the world? Now, from your perspective, and obviously you're going to have to give just the kind of starter to this question, but from your perspective, what are some of the kind of causes, if you like, of some of those, the kind of root causes of some of those conflicts around the world?
Yes, it's interesting. It's, I think, the second most popular question in this initiative that we've been looking at. Look, the world's a tough, messy, mean, complicated world full of tragedy and hardship and suffering. Now, a lot of conflict, war, terrorism will start and, in a sense, be developed in either failed or failing states. But what I would say is that in terms of sort of drivers of conflict, there are three points I would like to very quickly make, and it's a big subject, as you can imagine. The first reason for conflict and terrorism is the power of political elites. So many countries are plagued by these small ruling elites. You take President Bashar al-Assad in Syria. He's been president for 16 years. His father was president for 30 years before that. They head up a minority Shia tribe, the Alawites. Holding on to power is, in essence, their prime role in life, to hold on to it, partly because they've got the levers of power, the military, finance, but also they know that the Alawite, being a small minority tribe, will probably all be killed, every single man, woman, and child, if they were overthrown. So you can see why they're, in a sense, holding on to power. And you see it in other countries, too, where where ruling elites hold on to power for as long as they can. I think the second point I'd make is that a lot of fighting and subsequent conflict is based around the scramble for natural resources. It's no surprise that ISIS have moved from Iraq and Syria, although they're still there, they've established quite a significant presence in Libya, in and around the Sirte area, where there's a lot of oil, where there's a free movement of goods and money. You just have to look at places like Somalia, where the piracy was all about getting money, controlling the charcoal industry. The Taliban in Afghanistan are controlling the drug trade. And so it goes on. So in a sense, controlling natural resources becomes a real driver for conflict. In Congo, the precious metals, particularly coltan, are the substances that we all have in our mobile phones. And this is the third point I'd make, in that conflict and stirring up issues in people can be done so much quicker now than ever before. You know, globalization brings a lot of good, but the power of the media has got so stronger and stronger that it is much easier to manipulate things, not just on the internet, but in broad terms. Social media can be used to radicalize people. For, in a sense, Twitter, Facebook, and other, these are echo chambers for people's issues. So that's my third point, you know, the manipulation of the media. And whilst Karen and Mark's story is vivid and alive to all of us, I think one's got to remember, you know, the continent of Africa, many more people in that continent die every year from disease, from malaria, from traffic accidents than are killed in conflict or in terrorism. But it's the media that will always focus on the horrors, the immediacy of it. So those are the points that I'd make. I'm sure you'll talk more about sin. There is sin, and I'm afraid, you know, the questions about when will war end is when will sin end. I think it's the two sides of the same coin. But I would say my last point is that I still believe, having seen a lot of misery and a lot of trouble, that I still see there's more good in mankind than bad.
James, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. We appreciate it hugely. Thank you.